God commands us to let his word dwell in us richly in psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. We're to worship him musically. We're to proclaim his word musically. And so we want to train up our students, our children, to be able to sing skillfully with music, to understand what they're doing. Bible says sing with understanding. But it's all couched in studying God's word, growing up as Christian worshipers. Sometimes I know people are a little scared of music camp because maybe they're not a musical family, but it's for everybody. It's a mix of real beginners and more advanced students, and they help one another that way.
But the thing that really gives it weight and glory is that the whole week is focused towards a concert, a glorious presentation of the music we've been working on all week long. So there's this goal in mind. There's something that the students not just participate in, but actively create.
I'll see students who come in who have had no musical experience. You can tell they're overwhelmed by first day. They're just awed by it because they've been part of something that is new to them and much larger than them, something they've not experienced before. And I would say the majority of times, those kinds of students come back because they've tasted something that's really glorious, a foretaste of heaven.
These students are learning through the course of their time at music camp not to be music consumers, but to be active participants in making music. So not only to learn how to sing well, how to understand music as it's written on a page, and how it comes together in a group environment, but to be able to take those experiences and have them be the seeds that are planted for their involvement, their whole life, in the musical life of the church. We want these students to be the next wave of worshipers in the church who know how to sing to God.
Christians in AI. Should we get our hands in AI?
Our hands?
Should we get our dirty or our O's, zeros, and ones in AI?
Our minds?
Yeah. Hey, y'all, welcome to Cross Politics on the Fight, Laugh, Feast Network. Pastor Toby, I'm the water boy. Chuck Knox is out taking dominion. If you guys don't know, actually, me and my wife kind of rebooted Water Break.
Oh.
So we're kind of rebooting my show, Water Break. And my wife is joining me, and we're actually talking a lot about faith and fitness and health. And
faith and fitness.
Faith and fitness. It's a little cliche.
I like how you can do Water Break with that, too.
I know. It works for a while. That's why me and my wife are like, let's keep the branding since we already have it.
That's smart.
And so you got Water Boy and Water Girl on Water Break.
Oh, my goodness. She's the Water Girl?
But you can subscribe to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/waterbreak TV. TV is the forward slash there.
And you got the water kids.
And our next, that's
the water boy kids. And the water
like
girls.
Superheroes or something. but our next show, it's going to drop every Saturday. So every Saturday morning, okay. Usually about 9 a.m. All and right. our next show is actually basically post-mill health, what that should look like.
Post-mill health. How to live forever.
No, we don't promise any of that. We got this magic cream. You just put it on.
I just say, believe in Jesus.
Amen.
God the Father is waiting and looking down the road for all his prodigal sons to return. Will prodigal America return to the Father in repentance, confessing that Jesus Christ is Lord? Or will we fall to our own destruction and become a pillar of salt? As a memorial for other nations. Join us on Reformation Weekend this year, this fall, October 31st to November 2nd in Fort Worth, Texas, for the annual Fight Laugh Feast Prodigal America Conference. You will spend the weekend hearing from George Grant, Steve Dace, James White.
Don't announce him yet.
Doug Wilson.
Yeah, you can announce him.
Not the other one.
Not the other one.
And another guy. And me.
Okay, good.
And a live show with us and Knox.
And maybe some surprise guests there, too. It's a live show.
Okay. Singing psalms, feasting on good food, and, of course, we do beer and psalms the first night. Get tickets at prodigalamerica.com. Prodigalamerica.com. Get your tickets today. Come out to Fort Worth, Texas this fall, October 31st to November 2nd.
It's going
to
be a riot.
All right. Hey, we're really grateful to have with us two guests, the authors of a brand new book out, I believe, this week. Dr. Michael Collender, his life's passion is discovering more about the art and science of wisdom. He's taught in classical Christian schools for the last two decades. for his first PhD.
His first one.
He evaluated how different artificial intelligence models replicate brain functions. And for a second, theology, the relationship between wisdom and empirical psychology. Dr. Colander, thanks for joining us on Cross Politic.
It's good to be here.
And then Dr. Jonathan Shaw has been puzzling over the theological foundations of artificial intelligence for most of his life in the last two decades.
AI just came out just like last year.
No. Obviously you didn't read the book.
No.
PhD in machine learning and spent the majority of his career working on problems related to speech and speaker recognition.
Gabe, can he fix my speech and speaker problems?
I was going to say, you need to take some classes from Dr. Shaw.
Dr. Sounds
Shaw,
like it.
Thanks for joining us on Cross Politic.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And the brand new book out is called Wiser Than the Machine, The Value of Classical Christian Education in an Age of Artificial Intelligence. This is really fascinating. I think we need to start, though, really, really basic.
Like, dumb it down.
Like, for Gabe.
Yeah, please.
And maybe a friend of mine. So talk to me like I'm six or seven.
Mm-hmm.
What is AI? What is artificial intelligence and how does it work? Because it sounds scary. I don't know. Michael, why don't you start? And then I'd like to hear from Dr. Shaw as well.
Sure. Well, the idea behind artificial intelligence is that we can get a machine to think in some ways like a human being.
Okay.
And there's a lot of scariness about that, because if a machine can think like a human being, can it surpass us? Can it threaten us? And so a lot of the fear about artificial intelligence relates to that question and how it's going to be answered.
Could it control us? Like a controlling thing. Could it control us too?
Right, exactly.
Okay.
And so that those kinds of questions are the questions that we're wrestling with in the book.
Okay. Dr. Shaw, I'm going to give you a stab at this as well. So what is AI? How would you explain this to somebody just very, very simply?
All in small words.
Well, so the core of AI is you have some kind of input and you have some kind of output that you want. Think of like something that's supposed to recognize pictures and say it's a dog or a cat. You've got an input that's a picture, and then you have some kind of a complicated function that you run it through and it comes back with dog or cat.
Yeah.
That complicated function has a whole bunch of numbers in it. Lots and lots and lots of numbers.
Yeah.
And you can tweak them to make it do practically anything that you could want it to do. Do you want it to recognize dogs and cats? Do you want it to recognize cars versus bicycles? Do you want it? Doesn't matter. Whatever you want it to recognize, it can do whatever you want if you set those numbers right.
So, Dr. Shaw, that
artificial intelligence to set the numbers right and make it do what you want.
So that to me sounds like an algorithm. So what's the difference between an algorithm and AI?
So an algorithm, so yes, an AI actually is running algorithms. But the main difference in terms of how you think of them is that an algorithm is taking a series of steps that have a well-defined meaning. A person can look at this and check the logic and say, yes, this is going to do this and this is going to do this. And we've got all the cases covered. AI isn't quite thinking that way. It's using all of these, this big function to generate the output that you want, but the researcher has usually very little idea how that function actually does what you want it to do. The AI, as an AI researcher, the parts that we usually care about are, how do you set those numbers? How do you tweak those numbers to make it look right? How do you make this function so that it's capable of doing what you want it to do? These are the kinds of questions that we usually care about, and actually how it gets there, we don't really know a lot of the time.
Wait. Why do we not know how it gets there?
Well, so if you look at, say, GPT, you've got 300 billion parameters, something like that. And so this is 300 billion numbers describe how GPT decides what to say next when you talk to it. So if you're not familiar with GPT, you can it's a text engine. You can talk to it, type out questions, it'll answer. It's actually quite smart and it's very well well spoken. And how it actually manages to do that is it takes whatever it's typed out so far, including what you've typed out, and it runs it through this function and figures out what to say next. How it figures out what to say next is a function of these 300 billion parameters that got set by code. And we don't get to look at those. I mean, we can, but they're not useful.
Yeah. So Would it be fair to say AI is just a larger, more massive algorithm?
You could think of it like that. It's a very special class of algorithms where all of the, think of it closer to AI's writing code, because then you don't have to think about what the code does. It's not quite that, because it's not actually writing code, but it's writing instructions in a more parameterized way. It's basically writing out, this is how we're going to solve the problem, but it's not in a human readable format at all.
So
people actually probe these systems and try and figure out what they're doing. There's research papers trying to figure out how GPT-4 works.
Wow.
So you could still be in the situation where it's like garbage in, garbage out kind of thing.
Oh, yes. Yes. One of the key things about AI, though, is how those numbers all get set. So if I give you, here's 1,000 pictures of cats and 1,000 pictures of dogs, and for each one I say this is the right answer, then the algorithm runs by trying to figure out, it tweaks those numbers, all those 300 billion parameters, which actually there aren't that many in image recognition, but either way, tweaks all those parameters, and then it says, how many of these images did I get right? Well, I got 1,000 right, which is as good as a coin flip, because there's 1,000 of each. If I tweak it like this, ooh, I got 1,005 right. And then it tries it again, tweaks the numbers, tweaks the numbers, tweaks the numbers, tweaks the numbers, until it gets 99.5% of them right. And you go, awesome, we've trained this thing. Now we've got a system that does what we want it to do.
All right. So
I mean,
there's a lot there.
Yeah.
But I want to ask a couple of big picture questions again. Maybe I want to ask about the fears that people have, but I also want to ask about potential blessing. So, let's start with the fear and then we'll come to the blessing. Do Christians, maybe come back to you, Michael, do Christians need to worry about an iRobot scenario or maybe, I don't know, is the thinking also of like Minority Report. I know you're a big film guru, so I know you know these films, but I mean, are these realistic scenarios that Christians need to be aware of, that, you know, an iRobot or Minority Report sort of scenarios?
Well, for a number of reasons, AI really maximizes someone's power, right? So if I have this system and I can control it, and it has access to all of this data, and it is connected to the infrastructure that we need, whether it's through social media or, you know, power grids or whatnot, then can someone use that to control these various systems? Well, yes. In fact, we are able to see how that works with what's been happening recently with social media. We can see the power that the government has exercised, for instance, over Twitter, right? And those algorithms, and controlling how those algorithms direct information. So yes, that's a legitimate area of fear. But the other thing is that artificial intelligence, when it's not managed well, it opens so many opportunities for folly to be multiplied and for people to be really injured as a result of that. So evil and folly can be amplified through artificial intelligence.
One of the things, I don't know if you've read much of George Gilder, Michael, or Dr. Shah, but in Life After Google, one of the things he points out is directly with regard to AI, but I think broadly just sort of what he sees as sort of this Google megaplex vision. He sees it as heavily Darwinian and materialistic, and says, you know, he doesn't think that we need to fear those things, because ultimately, and I think this is kind of what you're getting at, if AI is ultimately just a massive tool, and it amplifies what people do, but it isn't, we're not really, we don't actually believe that non-sentient, you know, things can somehow take on sentience, can actually become intelligent in that sense, because that we don't believe in evolution. We believe in creation. Interact with that. I don't know what my question is exactly, but do you think Gilder is right?
Well, I haven't read Gilder's book, but there are two sides to that. One side is the question regarding Google, and Elon Musk, you know, had his conversation with Larry Page where it was very clear that Larry Page wants to make a digital god, and that mm-hmm. Google is essentially a giant factory, you know, workshop for making this digital god. That's really what right. they're after. And is there danger with that? Well, yes, because it's being built from a worldview of atheism. Mm-hmm. And can bad things happen? Can mistakes be made? Can wickedness and folly be just amplified through that? Well, of course. But on the other side, I think there's a danger with approaching artificial intelligence just simply saying, well, this simply can't be sentient just because I have these theological presuppositions. Yes. Do I have those theological presuppositions? And do I think that that's definitely the case that we're not going to make something with a soul? Yes. But I think it's very important for Christians to think through the actual scientific argument for why that wouldn't happen, or why from first principles we're not going to get that. Mm-hmm. And that's actually what we're addressing in the book. We are doing a deep dive into the technology and how it works to show from first principles why you're not going to have something like that be built.
I'm going to read this ad, and then Gabe's going to ask you to blow
yeah,
your mind.
I'll do that.
Are you concerned your child's current education won't give them the skills necessary to succeed in any area of life? Consider homeschooling with Classical Conversations. By applying the classical Christian model of education, the Classical Conversations curriculum encourages students to learn how to learn and how to think for themselves so they can adapt to every challenge life throws at them, including AI.
That's a great ad.
Join the I just added that part.
Oh, okay.
Join the over 50,000 families in 50 countries who have chosen to educate their children with Classical Conversations by visiting classicalconversations.com/FLF. That's classicalconversations.com/FLF.
So, blow my mind then. What is something good that AI can do that we haven't even thought of yet? Give me a place that I can invest and take my money and like run with it. Like what?
This is for both of you. So maybe Dr. Shaw first, we'll and give then him, Dr. Yeah. Collender. Blow our minds. What's something amazingly good that AI can do for us?
Well, personally, something I've always been excited about is Bible translation. I am the head of machine learning at a little company that's working on figuring out how to translate in and out of a ton of little tiny languages that have almost no written information, and that that big tech has not done very much with.
Mm-hmm.
There was a paper just 2 weeks ago, something like that, came out, where somebody figured out that you can take a grammar in a dictionary, which there have been linguists going out into the field and writing these all over the place for a long time.
Right.
They write these books on grammars, and then they come back and say, here's a grammar and a dictionary for this little language, and then they're done.
Uh-huh.
Somebody figured out that you can pass a grammar and a dictionary into one of these large language models, and then you can give it a sentence, and it'll translate into that sentence, and it can do it better than a human.
Ooh.
Wow.
That's post-mill.
So you could, basically what you're saying is, there's this unwritten language in some sort of tribe in Africa, and you could, using AI,
give it the grammar,
give it the grammar dictionary. And all that jazz, and the sounds. Would it be able to connect with like the sounds of how they speak?
So right now we haven't. This paper was about doing it with the grammar and a dictionary of a written language.
Yeah.
But unwritten languages are coming fairly fast. There's already language models that are tying together speech and text that are becoming very, very good right now.
That's a pretty good.
Yeah, that's
pretty
good.
All right, Dr. Collender.
All right, Dr. Collender, you have a high bar here, buddy.
Well, I think Jonathan just gave us an excellent one, and I'll just try to add as opposed to surpass. But AI allows us to study the body as a system and to trace systemic relationships between drugs and different diseases, different symptoms that would suggest that this process, you know, such and such a process is causing a disease. And what AI is going to allow doctors to do in not too long is to diagnose and discern problems inside the human body that will free up their time to work on other problems. And so I think we're going to have more diseases cured faster through the use of AI. That's one.
That's
and the second one is, I think it's AI is going to give, you know, people are worried about it taking away creativity for reasons that we explain in the book. We fundamentally think that is not going to happen for a number of reasons, but AI is going to give more tools, more paint and brushes to people to create things that we haven't even seen yet, that we can't imagine yet, because of how people will be standing on the shoulders of other creative people. So I think the world is post-millennially very bright.
Yeah, no, it's amazing how there have always, there's, you know, over and over again, as God has blessed a civilization with new technologies,
right.
There's often been a number of naysayers that say, this is going to destroy human creativity. This is going to destroy jobs.
Right.
And of course there's a period of disruption
transition
where people are trying to figure out what to do. But over and over again, what these gifts of technology do is actually free people up to do more in new and unthought of ways.
Right.
Toby, I think you're exactly right. And if I can add to that, it's one thing to say that, but it's another thing to be able to see exactly how and why and where. And that's what we're trying to address in the book, is we want to give people a framework to actually see where those opportunities are going to emerge.
So what are some of those opportunities, Michael?
Well, I don't want to give away the book, right? There's a whole framework for getting to that point.
You already got people that want to buy this.
Well, it is going to accelerate our abilities in a number of different areas. So one of the things that got me started with this book is I did a TEDx talk on rhetoric a couple of years ago. And as a result of that, I was invited to this high school to speak on Career Day. And I was thinking, well, you know, these kids, they're basically most of them are going to lose their jobs because of AI. And so I explained all of this to them. And I talk about this in the beginning of the book, just all of the jobs that are going to go away and how they're already being replaced with AI. And I gave very specific examples of specific businesses that are, their business model is built around just removing this sector of employment.
Yeah.
And so, what we do throughout the book is we explain how to approach all of this. And then the latter part of the book is the last chapter starts with the answer that I gave them, where I challenge them specifically on the kind of education that they were receiving.
Right.
And all of them recognized, it was amazing, there was this room of 700 students, and all of them vocally were saying, our education cannot help us with this. You know, all of the things that you're describing, we have no future, and this education is, you know, completely impoverished as far as their ability to see it. And what I found amazing was that they could see that the education that they were being given wasn't allowing them to see how to solve these problems.
So a big chunk of this book, a big part of this book, is actually arguing that this is why we need kids receiving a classical Christian education.
Yes.
And that's, you know, that's the subtitle of the book, The Value of Classical Christian Education in an Age of Artificial Intelligence. I'd love to hear from both of you on this. You know, again, without giving away the book, whet our appetite. Why is classical Christian education so important for a moment like this?
Jonathan, do you want to start this one, since I've had like two sections of answering questions?
So one of the core arguments that we make in the book is to look at AI and figure out what its limitations are. And the limitations of it express themselves directly in a way that it's directly tied to the nature of God and what theologians have been nailing down for a long time as the image of God.
Mm-hmm.
Which I might note, small sidebar, I found this fascinating for a long time, but AI actually has the ability from a technological standpoint to show us more tangibly what the limits of God are. So from a technology standpoint, we can actually do a little bit of practical theology and help that discussion move a little further.
When you say the limits of God, do you mean the limits of what exactly is the image of God?
Sorry.
No, it's okay.
Did I speak there?
I just wanted to make sure everybody understood that we're actually, we dial in on how technology allows us to see the image of God more clearly and how humans are distinctly made in his image. But we're giving a scientific argument for exactly where that point is in such a way that there are certain things that AI from first principles just doesn't reproduce, as cool as it is.
Right.
But it just can't show those things. So not to steal Jonathan's thunder, but I wanted you all to understand how cool what he's saying is.
Got it.
Yeah. So the limitations, what a computer can't do, informs us about what makes us so unique.
Mm.
And so we can more clearly understand
the
God placed into us by seeing what computers can't go beyond.
Right. Yeah. Well, and connect that
to classical
education, Jonathan. Yeah.
So those limitations, as I said, those are connected back to Aquinas' transcendentals, beauty, goodness, and truth. And those happen to be exactly the things that classical Christian schooling is focused on. And so we make an argument that boils down to that the education that students receive in a classical Christian education environment are focused on helping them love exactly the things and pursue exactly the things that AI can't pursue. It can't pursue that on its own. It has to follow us.
That's where, we are created in God's image. And so we can, copy him. We can, imitate him in the same way you're arguing that AI, especially as it comes to truth, beauty, and goodness, can only imitate its creator.
Right.
It's
us. And so beauty, goodness, and truth get pushed forward as we better imitate God, and AI lags behind us and follows us.
That's kind of a cool way to say that.
Yeah.
Michael, same question. What ways do you see classical education being so important for living in this moment?
Well, Jonathan has dialed in on the key element that makes classical education different. In addition, though, and this is one of the things that we address at the end of the book, it changes the way that a student learns and interacts with all of the different subjects. And it equips the student with skills that we do a deep dive on at the end of the book. And we show how truth, goodness, and beauty actually end up producing these skills. And that if you try to replicate these skills, yes, I know I'm being vague, but it's like a movie. I don't want to spoil the ending, right? But there's a way that the things that you want out of education actually come out of truth, goodness, and beauty in ways that would surprise you, right? Mm-hmm. It's not a matter of, hey, let's just talk about truth or let's talk about goodness and beauty. There's a way that to actually have the subjects work the way that they're supposed to, and for your children to get what you want them to get out of it, you have to have fundamentally truth, goodness, and beauty, which we point out are the attributes of God, right? We're not talking about Platonic transcendentals here. We're saying that the God through whom the God that we look at and we see through the created order, right? Romans 1, this is the whole point that Paul's getting at, that God is his nature, his character is actually what makes the subjects possible and the entire purpose for which we're educating children. And so the reason why I frame this conversation with speaking at this high school is those kids understood they're created in the image of God, right?
Yeah.
Even though they haven't been told this directly, they knew in their bones that the education that they were receiving was not equipping them in these areas to face a world where AI is a dominant force. And classical Christian kids, even though they might not have been told this, they have been prepared for years, right? Kids who've been raised up and educated in this approach have actually been prepared for a world in which AI is going to be a dominant force.
So
now I show exactly why.
Now that I've been kind of walked through this interview, I've listened to you guys. Who's this book for? Is it for the people who want to code with AI, or you know, who's this book for?
Well, fundamentally, it's for Christians who are wanting to raise their kids in the nurture and admonition of the Lord and understand how to think in this world where we're surrounded by AI. But there's a secondary argument as well, which is addressing the people who want to argue that, and there's a sense in which there's an apologetic thrust to the book, where we're addressing the arguments of people like Ray Kurzweil, of Larry Page. I would almost say Elon Musk, except I think in a number of ways, Musk is actually more of a friend in thinking through AI than he is somebody who's opposed to artificial intelligence and what we're talking about. But what we tried to do was present the case for classical Christian education in a way that made it clearly robustly defensible for Christians. But also we wanted to create the kind of book that a guy like Elon Musk might read with his expertise, or an AI engineer, and see, hey, they've got a point.
Yeah.
This is robustly defensible.
Interesting.
All right. I think we should
go backstage.
We're going to go backstage now.
And I want to know what his favorite AI engine is. Is it Grok? Is it ChatGPT? Okay,
yeah, I'm going to try to squeeze just a little bit more out of them.
Yeah.
And get some
juice out of that.
Yeah. I mean, I know he's trying to,
he's being coy.
He's a little coy, but maybe Dr. Shaw will be a little bit more malleable.
Yeah. Maybe they just need a little scotch. Maybe that's what it is.
That's probably what they needed.
That's definitely
scotch.
What we need.
Yeah. All right. If you're single, get married. If you're married, have kids. If you have kids, go baptize them. Until tomorrow, love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. Hang around for backstage.
Wiser than the machine.
Oh. Amazon?
I don't know. Is that where you buy it? Amazon?
Yeah, get it on Amazon.
Okay.
All right.
Like, we did that before the music was finished.
Yeah.
How do you choose who to trust? Doesn't it usually come down to personal connection? Then why do only 25% of people trust a real estate agent when our job is all about connection? Sounds like there's something missing. Here at Story Real Estate, we're looking for people with integrity and a willingness to serve others. When people get to know you in this career, they should discover a genuine and helpful person who can guide them through tough times. If that's you, join us today. I'm Chris Carpenter, the owner and founder of Story Real Estate. Click the Learn More button and let's see if we have a career you'll love.